Welcome to the No Film School podcast. This is Gigi Hawkins. I'm here with
Jason Hillerman. I'm here. Yeah.
We're here. It's the two of us. We're having a conversation catch up. It's been a minute, and it's so good to see you and hear you back on the podcast. I missed you, Jason.
I missed you too. It's amazing to have you back. And I know we're going to lose you in a week to go shoot a feature film, which we're all very excited about. So,
yeah. Which, you know, we talked about last week on the podcast, the writing process of it with your friends and now my friends, Matt and Eric, whose film Wine Club is now officially announced. I was feeling so energized from that conversation. But before we dig into the nitty-gritty of being a couple days out now from actual production, which sounds like unreal that I'm even saying it, let's talk about the strike and where we're at. It is September 9th is when this episode is coming out. We're recording it on September 4th, 2023.
And Happy Labor Day.
We're working on Labor Day. What does that say about the state of the world? That we're happy to be here, honestly.
Yeah, truly. We would have this conversation no matter what. So just audio recording, it's not a big deal for me.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The strike is in such an interesting position because I think, honestly, it feels so fortuitous it's Labor Day. There's a lot of conflicting reports out there, so I thought I'd just break it down for the listeners in a really easy way. The writers, the WGA and the AMPTP got back together and started talking in early August. Basically, the AMPTP put forward an idea of like, hey, you guys should settle for this. We came back with a counter. They came back with something. Then we came back with a counter. So where we are at right now is as of August 15th, so over 2 weeks ago, the writers have sent a counter to the AMPTP. And instead of actually negotiating, what happened was they walked away from the table, the AMPTP, and we haven't heard from them since. They released their idea of what a fair deal would be in the trades and thought it would put pressure on writers to settle. But there was a lot of backlash online, a lot of backlash socially, and just in talking to people on the lines. You know, it was an agreement that didn't really take care of AI. The language was really loose and didn't have enough definitions. It didn't take care of a staffing minimum. It sort of left things up to the showrunners, which is a big conversation online. Like, why shouldn't the showrunners be the people who are the ultimate decider? Well, I think it sounds like a really good idea in theory, except when you really think about it, right? So, Gigi, if you were the showrunner of a TV show, and I said, Gigi, you have $100,000 to make this TV show. You can hire as many writers as you want, but also that $100,000 has a stretch over to production. You suddenly are going to hire the fewest amount of writers and then to use the rest of the money. So the idea there is having that set idea for showrunners to pick, it provides the studios with enough leverage, especially for newer showrunners to say, hey, don't you want this money for your show? Why would you hire more writers when we could be using it for production or VFX or whatever? And I think it puts in kind of an undue burden on a showrunner who might then try to take on more or work people harder because they need the money to stretch further. So that was another big thing. And then there was nothing in it for feature writers. So feature writers for these negotiations were looking for things like weekly pay instead of just waiting 6 to 8 months to get a paycheck or, you know, or some other different provisions. There was no added benefits for feature writers. So where we're at is kind of a standstill. Like I said, the WGA sent the AMPTP a counter offer on August 15th. The AMPTP hasn't come back to the table or talk to them since then. So, and the real issue is like, you don't want to negotiate with yourself, right? I don't think anybody out there wants to, you know, everybody sort of understands you can't keep adjusting your offer until someone says yes. You know, it's supposed to be a back and forth game. So we're really just waiting to see where this is going to go. You know, I've heard reports all over of people talking or back channel conversations. And, you know, I'll remind people that a lot of it is just chatter. Some of it is, most of it or most of the time, you know, what's happening behind the scenes is something we're not going to be privy to, that it's not going to make it to the headlines. So people are always looking for something to print. Right now, we're at a bit of a standstill. It sucks on Labor Day to be sitting here not knowing where we're going back. But the nice thing about something like this is the CEOs have the control, right? If they wanted to take this offer and they want to end the strike, they could come back tomorrow and we can get things going. You know, we could get a deal that we could ratify and vote on and get back to work. So I'm hoping that by the time this airs, they're talking again. Maybe that's something that comes out of this weekend and we'll kind of go from there. But yeah, right now that's that. And that doesn't even cover the SAG portion, which they still have not come back to the table to talk to SAG. So, you know, that'll be interesting to cover as we move forward. How fast could they go? Will SAG be able to draft off any of the WGA points? Will they stop talking to WGA and go back to SAG? You know, like these are all the big questions that are raining down right now. And we're finding out in real time what the answers are.
I think that you bring up two points about the things that we're looking for more of that come back to an idea that was summarized really well in the Up First Sunday story, which is the NPR daily news show. And there is a piece about the way we think about work. And one of the things that the guest that they were interviewing, who's a poet and wrote a book about rethinking like our approach to work, he basically was speaking about this idea of work being a religion. We worship our work. And I think that's even more so or in this film industry where one, we're told that like this is like the dream factory, but two, we're also told that like it's a privilege to be able to do this work, which yes, that's it is in a lot of ways to be able to tell stories, but it is still a job. And I think that we need to remember how important it is to be able to have a sustainable life when you are doing any job. And that should be a priority. It shouldn't be something that you're sort of pushed aside. Well, you get to be a showrunner so you can take on this other thing.
Exactly.
If you've ever talked to a showrunner, it is an incredibly difficult job. You are, you know, running everything. And to add one more sort of pressure point, it's not fair to the people in those positions. And so I think that it's, you know, and then going to back to your point about like wanting feature writers wanting to be paid weekly, like that is not a out of the, it's not a crazy ask. I think that's a fair ask. And I think that like normalizing sustainable ways of working is really important for us to do at every stage. And we've talked a lot about doing this as an indie filmmaker. And I think that if we're normalizing these like unhealthy ways of working and this work-life balance that, you know, is distorted by the glamour of Hollywood at the indie level and at the emerging filmmaker level and at the film school level, then of course it will carry over into these more corporate studio spaces. And so I think educating yourself and having conversations with your team and people that you work with always about how to be working smart and how to be working in a way that allows people to be humans, bringing the humanity back to it all. I think it happens at every level. So I'm so glad that you highlighted that.
Yeah, I think the myth of the starving artist or the paradigm of the starving artist, it's very fun. It's something we've heard before and it, you know, you whatever bleed for your work, but at a certain point in a certain level, it's like, that's done. You should be able to
It's not sexy. Like, exactly. We don't like wondering where our food is going to come from.
Exactly.
Like, you know, I think that it is a myth. You know, there's also this like glorification of like drinking while making art. Like that doesn't need to be a thing. Like, so we should be questioning these norms.
Yeah, exactly. I think working the way that works best for us, but also just finding a way where you can have like, you know, the nuclear family, if that's what you want or whatever, like under the paychecks of, you know, working in thriving in Hollywood. You know, again, it's like not everybody wants to be a millionaire, right? Like there's certain people out here who are very, you know, driven that way. But a lot of it is just how do I have the basic necessities and do this? How do I put my kids into school? How do I, you know, make a Costco run every 2 weeks and make it count? You know, how do I not go into massive credit card debt being out here? And I think with rising rents, with everything, you know, the affordability of Los Angeles and all that, you know, it's finding a way where we can all come together. Because I think the thing that I'll always go back to is with the AMPTP is like these CEOs who are making tens of millions of dollars, you know, these aren't worries for them, right? They're not sitting here like, how, you know,
have a kid?
Exactly. Yeah. The price of beef at Costco's up, you know, like we're getting turkey again. All these sort of limited aspects or just, you know, gas in LA is at $5 a gallon again. You know, it costs $56 to fill up your tank in, you know, a normal sedan. Like this is expensive, but you know, they're taking jets other places. They don't know what's going on. So I hope the fervent chatter on the lines and everything like that, I hope we're reaching an end and that we're pushing towards something. Because I do think the change we're trying to enact now will affect generations of writers and directors and, you know, people yeah. and actors and people who are in this industry. And it can only help for the better, right? So that's my goal. And I think on this Labor Day, you know, we'll raise a fist in the air and hope we yeah. reach conclusion soon. Yeah.
It's so crazy because I'm like having thoughts for the first, like you're about to go on your honeymoon. You got married yeah. recently. Like I'm having conversations where I'm like, okay, when would I be able to have a kid and like still have a career? And do I have to like jumpstart my career first before that? Like, you know, it's like these ticking human just yeah. lifetime pressures are being consolidated. Like it's this pressure cooker. And I think that like, yeah, it's.
Yeah. I mean, my wife is a fertility nurse in Los Angeles. Shout out Sally. And I think like that's 99% of her clientele, right? Are people who work in film and television who are like, hey, I don't know when I'll be able to afford this. And I think that's kind of terrifying that such a, you know, a market here, but also, you know, for me, nice to be able to have that conversation in home with an expert, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for the update on this front, and we will be staying tuned. And you've been doing some excellent coverage on the No Film School site as well. So I appreciate you watching out for us.
Yeah, always. And as the invitation's always open, Fox, come out to Fox and pick it with me. You know, we've got a really good crew. I have my...
Have any listeners come?
You know what? We have a listener who's a captain there. Her name is Debbie, and she's also an amazing writer at her pilot this
Shout
week.
Shout out
and
to
it
Debbie.
Was so good. So, you know, I see Debbie there every day, and we talk all the No Film School podcast on Thursdays. That's our afternoon chatter. And, you know, I think picketing's only 9 to noon now. So if you have time in the morning, you know, come on out, swing by Fox, swing by Eddie Studio. We'd love to have you. And it's awesome being out there with people going through the same thing. I think if you're going through so much of writing, at least for me, in features is a solitary endeavor. So being out there in solidarity with people, yeah. I don't know, you're never going to find anything better. It's kind of that communal. The only other feeling you get is on a film set, right?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Should we use this to transition? Into
yeah, segue
true,
away. Yeah. Someone's going to a film set soon. Yeah.
Yeah. So for our listeners, I'm not really posting about it because I want to protect the sort of like, nature of this project. It's a ultra low budget indie film, like the most independent you can get. And we're shooting in Panama. The way it came to be was I had access to this place in Panama on an island in Panama and for one time only. And it's this fall during the dry season, during the non-tourist season. And then we lose access to the location forever. And I looked around and I think I talked to you, Jason. I'm like, would this be crazy? And I like looked to my producer, L. Roth Brunette, and I was like, would you want to make something? And then I looked to my DP, Ryan Thomas. I was like, would you want to make something? And then I looked to my two actors who are the leads of the short Yes Daddy that's like
yeah.
just sort of done its festival run,
festival
Madison Lacey and Scott yeah, Monahan. Exactly. Thank you. We went to Salute Your Shorts and got an honorable mention. It was my first like accolade like that. And
yeah.
it's so nice, especially because this is a short that like I had two people say it doesn't work and you have to cut the first half. Yeah. And I was like, I think you don't get it. And I'm going to listen to my gut and I'm going to listen to the woman who wrote it, Madison Lanasey, also acted in it. I'm going to listen to her gut. I'm going to follow yeah. my mantra of make something that my friend Charlotte Laffler, who doesn't work in the industry, will enjoy. She loves indie film and make something that will make my dad cringe.
Perfect.
And yeah. and it worked. Oh my God. It's called Yes Daddy. I mean, I had to show it to him on Christmas when we got into the Mammoth Festival. He's like, what short? And I was like, turn my laptop around. And I'm like, just, I didn't write it. And I pressed play and ran away.
No, Dad, great. It's an homage to me.
Yeah. Poor Larry Hawkins, shout out to you for being a champ. He laughed.
Sure.
So I was like, Madison, Scott, like, would you want to do this thing? Like, take a big leap with me onto this truly indie experiment. It's an experiment because I hadn't written the script. And I was like, okay, taking Charles's advice, sticking a flag in the ground. We're just going to go out there and make this thing. And then I wrote something knowing that it would be starring Madison and Scott. And you saw some very early drafts of that, Jason.
Yeah. The earliest drafts. Yeah.
The earliest drafts way back in the day. And I think also knowing that it was just like, we're just going to go and make something.
Yeah.
Like without any support, like we're raising money from family and friends and I'm paying for it and putting things on my credit card and getting those points. Yeah. But I'm kind of like, well, there's such like so few opportunities like this present themselves to make something. So it feels like this experiment in a way. And I'm treating it mentally like it's my grad school thesis, my no film Absolutely. School thesis. I'm 4 years out of leaving my corporate career. So the timing makes sense. And then I wrote this little thing and I love it. Like I wrote a couple drafts of it, but I love it. And I love how it's like the first draft of it, we did a little table read and I was like, oh my, yikes. Yeah. This is like a weird broad comedy, which is so not me. And it has evolved into this like subtle sort of like in the vein of like a bigger splash, The White Lotus. We keep coming back to Force Majeure, which is like, I mean, I'm putting out really big names, but this is a baby movie. But I'm learning so much and I'm in the trenches and I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm sometimes like, oh, I need to respond to this email. And I'm figuring out how to cast, like all these things are happening and I'm in the trenches. So what we were thinking today is maybe we go through a no film school production checklist. Oh my gosh.
You want to go through it? So we have a no film school production checklist for directors. And there are three little checklists, a pre-production, a production checklist, and a post-production checklist. So we can probably leave the post off. But I want to go through the pre-pro and the production with you just to see what you, if you're doing, you know, how you're doing things. And
will I get a grade?
You know what? You've got an A in my book. I've already read the script. So, you know, I think you're probably pretty well off. But let's go through some of this stuff.
Okay, and to our listeners, I swear I haven't seen this list. And there may be answers where I'm like, I think my producer's handling that. But this is for directors,
I mean, the first thing on this list is casting, which, you know, we kind of went through. But other than your two stars that you knew, how did you dive into casting the other roles?
So there are two other characters that were in the process of casting. One is in the story, this couple, they're on their delayed honeymoon about a year into their marriage. And he's sort of this like golden boy people pleaser. And she is starting to really become worn down by how much the world loves him. And in a sort of like attempt to revive things with their relationship, they agree to have a menage a trois with the person who is the rental host or sort of hosting their rental house on this island in Panama. So that third is somebody that we're still casting. And they have to work within the person. And we've also been auditioning people through casting network, but because we're still figuring that out. And there are people who I'm like, oh, could be this person. But like, I want to see more because it's such a specific role. It's been hard to get a volume of people. And then there's another character, this woman who lives on the island, who's an expat, who ended up there because she got voted off first on a Survivor-like show and then got kind of like stuck in this expat backpacking world. And what's interesting about that is we had a ton of amazing people come in. And I'm like, there are so many options, but I can't cast this character until I cast the other character because I'm casting off of that person.
Yeah.
So casting networks was how I ran it. The system was a little bit clunky at times and I had to like email people to do chemistry reads because I couldn't send all the details and send updated slides. Also, you know, we're all wearing so many hats, so it's probably in there, but I couldn't find it in the source article. And then we're doing some like proactive recruiting. So that's how we're going about casting. Friends, family, internet. Hustling.
Yeah, so much of it, I think, is that hustle. But also, like, chemistry is maybe the most underrated part of this because with an indie, you're going to want to leave the cameras rolling so much just to get these moments and get people feeling whatever. It's, you know, if they don't have that chemistry, they're going to be wooden the whole time. You know, it's almost like you have to relax them and also hopefully they're relaxed with each other enough to pull off such an intimate story as well.
Yeah. And Madison and Scott, they have that chemistry.
Right.
That makes me laugh. I laugh a lot around them. That's the danger is me laughing during takes. So I have to like really get in the zone.
Yeah, you got to muff them.
Okay, so do I get that point?
You get that point. We kind of went over locations, but like, what about location scouting? Like, have you been to this place in Panama? How are you handling that?
I've been there a couple times when I was in middle school.
Right.
I think half my life ago. And so we know the locations we want to shoot in, and we know the house that we're shooting in, but we have, somebody went down on the island and recorded videos looking at all the locations. So we've been using that with storyboarding and shot listing with our DP to basically put together our shot list and create overhead so we can see where we're putting the camera, where the actors are being blocked. But, you know, what if it rains? One of the places in Panama that I thought we were going to shoot at, I learned burnt down, then fell down. and then, of course, you know, we're going to this backpacking town where somebody sent a video of like a bar on a Friday, like during the day. And it had hundreds of people partying there. So there's like these unknown things and these unknown factors. And like, we know we're getting 10 minutes of thunderstorms at least once a day,
yeah,
but we're going during the dry season. So like, that's intentional.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you could, like I said, like you could roll through those thunderstorms, people running around, goofing, you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
like walking through this town, like any of that B-roll of them just walking past these party goers, stuff like that is going to be, look, it's free. Free extras, yeah, right? You know, and free scale, right? That's one of the things we talk about a lot on. I talk a lot with any indie filmmaker. How do we get scope and scale into this idea where it doesn't, you know, it's not about being confined. So much of your story is about freedom of the human spirit. If I could, I'll just try with that. But you kind of want those wide open spaces and the ability to get those giant wide shots or different things or a lot of people in frame without it necessarily being about a lot of different things, you know?
We have a mantra that is always be filming.
Yeah.
So we can get those things. And then we also have come up with something called the sloth shot. Like if we see a sloth in nature, like without disturbing the sloth,
yeah,
respecting the sloth, like we have a little bit of time for the sloth to cross the road. Like,
yes.
How do we pivot so we can get the sloth shot?
I think it's one of the most important shots out there, you know?
Thank you.
I'll give you a point for that. What about, so you touched a little bit briefly on storyboarding. Now, I know that's like, you know, you and the DP working back and forth. Like, for a script like this, is it, you know, will you be really strict with your shot lists or is it figure it out or, you know, are you shooting handheld? How, you know, what's happening? Yeah.
So we have we're trying to storyboard all the major scenes. And there are some, because this is a story that's so much about what is not said, like very rarely are the characters actually saying what they're feeling. Where we put the camera is so important. And there are times where like it will feel more stilted and it will be on sticks.
Sure.
And then there are times where we'll have camera moves. And then we do have these moments where there are handheld shots. And actually, when we were at Holly Shorts the other weekend with Yes Daddy, we were watching this short film called Tall, Dark, and Handsome from director... Hold on, I'm looking.
Great title.
Sam, I know, Tall, Dark, and Handsome from director Sam Barron, I want to say.
Okay.
Who, ironically, I had seen his first short in this trilogy of shorts when I went to the Austin Film Festival like 5 years ago and was like, didn't know anything. I went there, got a pass, and just watched films. I didn't have any films or anything at all. And then I was like, wait, I know you and I know this actor. Like, did I meet you at another festival? And I was like, oh, I met you when I was a baby filmmaker. But so Sam Barron's short, Tall, Dark, and Handsome, had this amazing handheld scene between a couple fighting. And when it was on, right when the credits hit, I took my hand and I grabbed Ryan's shoulder in a non-invasive way. And I said, the handheld. And we both looked at each other and we're like, the handheld and that. Perfect. So we have those moments where we are switching into handheld. But we are basically doing overheads for every scene. You letting that help sort of time out the schedule. And
smart.
I'll caveat that Ryan and I have also, when we were doing a Channel 101 series, we intentionally didn't storyboard one of the episodes so we could try to see what it's like, because we're going to have to flex.
Of course. Yeah.
But we're trying our best to have everything plotted out beforehand.
Yeah.
So we can pivot for this last shot, or when we run out of time, inevitably we simplify a shot. And then we're also being like, okay, this, there's a scene in the sort of the towards the end of Act One where Madison Lannissey's character kind of has like a little bit of a break of some sort to the bartender who's serving them breakfast while her husband is next to her, which we're calling the Chevy Chase scene.
Yes. Plane, trains, and automobiles. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. And this is so like, this is like the millennial female version of that. And we're like, this is such a performance scene that we don't have to be anything fancy with the camera. Let's let the performance unfold.
Yeah.
So that's how we're planning it. We do the overheads and then we put that in an app that Ryan built called Glide. It's incredible. And then he's entering on the back end all of the information that the camera team, that his team will need.
Great.
And the gaffer and the grip, like all of it will be there. So it's just about pulling it off on the
day.
That's
awesome. Yeah. I'll say, I was just giving a buddy notes on his short a couple weeks ago, I guess, maybe a month ago at this point. One thing that he talked about, which I thought was really prescient and you know, information that I wrote down for myself and I'll share with you, is the one thing he said. He's like, I wish we had storyboarded more transitions between the scenes. Because he was like, a lot of times we'll be in the edit and we'll have gotten everything we wanted, but not thought about how it connects to the next thing. And I thought that was such a smart thing. And he inspired me, honestly, in a couple of different ways. So he's like, I just write them now into the script. Or I'm like, we're going to fade to this. We're going to go into that. Like, so I can feel the vibe. And when I'm watching it in my head, like, you know, I'm like, okay, this will connect. And if it doesn't connect or we have to cut this scene later, I know that we can fade between these other two or hard cut. Or I can, you know, worst case scenario, like add some transition-y B-roll, whatever. And I thought that was like so smart. And honestly, it's something for my latest spec. Almost in between every major scene, I like wrote in like how we transition, mostly because I felt like it's kind of a vibe spec. And also like, oh yeah, I want to see what this movie looks like in my head. So there's like a little parting information I'll give you there.
That's so good. I just wrote that down and it's interesting. I edit in my head hard cut jokes. So like a scene that cuts to another scene, like that's really easy for me. And we have some really funny, like almost horror moments. And you know, I'm like weird and like horror adjacent always. But I think there are some other smooth finessing transitions that we need to figure out. Or is it like buttons on scenes? Yeah. Like there's a couple of scenes where I'm like, and then I know we end in this wide where like he flops down in the sand, like because he's just exasperated.
I mean, I love a good match cut. Could he flop down in the sand and then match cut to flopping in the bed, you know? Yeah.
How satisfying is that when it happens? One other thing that I want to describe in the process of like getting to storyboarding and prep is that Ryan and I have Ryan discovered this as a DVD set, a HollywoodCameraWork.com. So they have a couple of different softwares, including like a shot designer. It's an app called Shot Designer that we use. And then he also, or this team, and it's a man named Pear something that produces these films. And I think he's the founder. I apologize if I'm getting that wrong. But they created a course called the Master Course in High-End Blocking and Staging. And you can rent it. It's like, there's, I think, 6 or 7 classes. And then you can rent it for $9 a pop. And so Ryan and I watch like 5 or 6 of these little videos about blocking and staging and place in camera movement before we do our shot listing. So we're kind of like stirring up all this dust from our, you know, early days. And, and it jumpstarts our creativity. And we're like, oh, like we should be staging them in this S shape. And the camera can move this way. Or we start here and then we end in a close-up. Or you know, we're simply creating multiple different shots within a frame. And so that has been like has been nourishing for my soul as a filmmaker, watching these all these not animatronic, they're computer generated models of animatics of how to be thinking about moving the camera. And a lot of these scenes, it's like I will narrativize them in my head, and I'm like, it's amazing how camera placement can make you feel something. Because I'm looking at this scene and it's just like a blank faced woman in a red dress and a blank faced man in a blue shirt. And they move around a desk. And I'm like, oh shit, this drama is real.
It changes everything.
No context. Yeah. It changes everything. So I highly, highly recommend that as a resource. Yeah. And I'm going to do this. It's part of my process now. Okay. Do I pass that?
You pass that one. Here's the big one I'll say. How do you schedule a movie like this? Are you doing it by sequence? Are you shooting in order? Like, what's the, you know, how do you pick your days? How many days are you shooting?
Yeah. Originally, I was like, I want to shoot in order because the actors are going to get more sun exposure and sure. bug bites, and it'll like show on screen, and that's part of the production value. But then it just didn't make sense because we just don't have a budget. We're shooting for 11 days in Panama, 5 days on, 2 days off, 5 days on, 2 days off, 1 day, because we want to make sure our crew is rested and our talent is rested. And so we have sort of done shooting by location.
Yeah.
So we're going to have 1 day where we're just shooting on the water. If anyone's ever shot it on the water in like an open boat ocean, I'm open for all advice and tips. We're trying to keep it pretty simple, but like we're pretty much block shooting and trying to minimize moves or around the sun. So we don't want to be shooting outside when it's the middle of the day because it doesn't look as good.
Yeah.
This is the benefit of having a DP who comes from the world of lighting, because he's always thinking about that. And we don't have hair and makeup. Like, it's something that I'm tag teaming with the actors, and we're going to let them be au naturel, which I hope like we'll have oil bladders and powder, but I hope that
get as many oil bladders as possible. Yeah.
But like, they have beautiful skin right now. So I hope that's something. And if anyone has any insight, I've never heard of anyone. And I was posting to my Instagram story about like people shooting with their natural skin, but like, I know it's been done before.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely been done before. I think it's just like, yeah, you just want to make sure you don't get the shine. And then also like, as many diffusers or whatever you can do, even if it's like the sun and natural, just like to, you know, spread the light
soften
out. It's always nice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Those are the big things. So like schedule-wise, you're going to shoot a little bit out of order. Do you have like a plan in terms of maintaining the, like how you'll direct these people? Like, hey, you're in this mindset. And then maybe in the afternoon, you're in this one.
Yeah, we did with one of the actors, Scott, who actually was on Anchorage last week. So you've already heard his voice. He is heading to the UK. He's there right now. So we had to do a bunch of rehearsals. So I did all my Scott and Madison rehearsals. And it was interesting to be able to pop in. And we kind of block shot them as if, I filmed them on my iPhone, which is something that Ryan says has been so helpful for blocking, just see the performances. And we ran them in order, but I started to find this thing that was really interesting from a storytelling perspective. I feel like there are twin and triplet scenes.
Ooh.
So like there are scenes that near each other at different parts of the story. So there's a scene
great.
In the very beginning where like she comes down in like he's just worked out and he's getting coffee and she's like, do you want to intermittent fast with me? And he's kind of dancing around saying like, I don't want to do it because I work out in the morning, but he's such a people pleaser. And then he's kind of dancing around and she's like, fine, we'll eat breakfast. And so it's their like kind of dance in the kitchen. Then later on, after something happens and information is revealed, and I don't want to spoil it, there's another scene in the kitchen where she is getting information and she is put on her heels. And so I'm like, these are twin scenes. And how have things changed in their power dynamics beforehand? We have three scenes in the bedroom between them, the main couple. And it is fascinating to see how different the dynamic is right when they get there, when things are just kind of like off, but they're going through the motions. And then how things get ignited at the midpoint in a way between them that is unexpected. And then when something happens at the end and how that is so different. So like, I think when I'm talking to the actors on set, I'm going to be reminding them kind of like where this scene is at in the context of like its twin and triplet scene.
Oh,
and then of course, what happened right before, what information you have, and then what, and usually like leaving out what happens after. But it's so interesting how like story just permeates at every stage.
How will you handle just improv in general? You know, we touched last week with Matt and Eric about improv on their set and the script. And, you know, you've worked with these actors before, which I think gives you an advantage. But just like, where's the level of improv when you get into some of these scenes? And, you know, how do you keep them on track considering you're going to have a pretty tight schedule in general anyway?
Yeah, such a good question, especially because these actors are such talented improvisers to the point that I like laugh on set because they're so funny. But in the writing process, with Scott and Madison, we did a bunch of improv exercises. I know like Linklater did this. And it was really important for me to have what they're saying be in their voices.
Yeah.
Madison, when you read her voice in script form, it's like this transatlantic way of talking. Like the words she says are so bizarre. And you probably read it and you're like, who is this actor voice? Like, what is this character voice? But the way it's so true to her. Like, for example, there's a line in Yes, Daddy, which you can watch on my website, where he's like, do you like that? And she says, yes, very much so. And I'm like, what is this? Like the 1920s? and so like I did a lot of improv workshopping where I'm like, okay, this is the scene as I wrote it. Now let's do it where we forget the lines. And I incorporated that into the script. I'm also working with Ryan to choose my shots where we know like the unsaid things need to happen. Like we need to see the love for them as actors or like as two characters, because you know, it's not shown so much in the script because I was writing it for a production, but I know that it needs to be there. So we're finding these moments where they come together and like we're letting them improvise. And then with every character or everybody that we auditioned, we also had them do an improv run.
Oh, cool. 'Cause
like, I'm not precious about the lines, like if it doesn't sound good in the script. We auditioned this woman who is Russian and she was so like, would be such a wild card for casting this role. So not what I expected, but there was something about her that was so kind and earnest and wise that I was like, and when she did her improv version of the scene, I was like, oh, this is like amazing. I just want to be like listening and soaking all of this goodness up. So there's an element of, I think, improv within structure, but
right.
I don't think we can go as like mumblecore improv.
Yeah.
Like we can't afford to. The way that we're placing the cameras, like people need to deliver on their lines and it needs to make sense. Like it needs to make sense for the story.
Yeah. I always try to make like a mile marker, especially when I'm meeting with directors, just like, hey, these are the things that probably need to be said out loud. You know, and with obviously different stories, there are different mile markers, right? Like when I did Shovel Buddies, there wasn't that many expositional things. It's just like, you know, kids and it should be vibes and whatever. But like when you're working on different things, like I'm doing this action movie right now, a lot of it is like, hey, some of this matters, you know, the reason why someone's beating the shit out of someone else matters. It can't just be vibes.
The key
is
in the pocket. And
exactly.
The audience needs to know the key is in the pocket, the back pocket.
Exactly. So it's finding those mile markers. And then honestly, I think a lot of that sometimes makes me a better writer because then I'll sit there and be like, all right, well, what don't I need? You know, like what can I take out, or what's the most I can take out, or could you do something with a look or with body language? And some of that just winds up being left up to the actors too. So it sounds like you have a pretty good balance there. And I'll say, like, you know, if there's ever time, it's like run through a scene with like the most amount you could say, the least amount you could say. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what, do one where you're really freaking out and you talk as much as you want, and do one where you're doing it silently. You know, it's like letting people stretch out or work out. 'Cause I do think there's always some gold to be mined there, even if it's just a fraction of a take and you know, back and forth.
I may send you this draft after this week to do a mile marker check.
Yeah.
Because you generally know how, you know, the origins of it. And then you haven't seen this like workshop improvised, like taking the improv workshops into it.
Sure.
And then I'm incorporating a couple more notes that are more like nothing is changing in the story. And there's a twist I can't wait to hear your thoughts about. But it's like that fresh take of like gut checking, are the mile markers there for the audience? Because like it's really tough to see that when you're in the trenches.
Are you running single cam or multicam or what are you?
Single.
Single, yeah. So you're really going to have to, you know, it's like capturing lightning in a bottle at times, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fun. I mean, look, this is the right challenge, right? It's like we kind of said where you are at your in your career. It's like, yeah, this is the time to make something. You know, like you can really, you get to a certain point where you can really only learn by doing. You know, you can write the script, you can do whatever, but until you're on set, until you're facing the 10-minute thunderstorm, you really don't know what you're, you know, you can't learn anymore from just being on the sidelines, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the reasons that I feel safe to be talking about it here, because I don't know, for some reason, No Film School has always been a space where I come to learn.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I'm at with this whole team. Like from every time we've worked together, it's like we're wearing a hat of like curiosity and learning and obviously like doing our best to make the best thing possible. But I'm kind of taking the pressure off of like, I'm making the best film ever. No, I'm getting my first rep in, and the script itself is 72 pages long. We are shooting one scene in LA later on, which like is a whole thing that I'm like starting to wrap my mind around because it takes place on an airplane and we're looking for a standing set and we're looking to figure out how to make that work. And with a very tiny budget, because it is an ultra low budget, to the point that I'm like, I laugh and then I'm like, the tears are coming out because I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. But I feel like protecting it and taking the pressure off, and like, we're not going to be posting on social media about it until it's done. Sorry, there's a fire truck.
Oh, yeah. I was like, is that you?
I'll mark it. Yeah, we're not going to be posting on social media about it because I don't want that pressure. I think we are going to do a Seed and Spark campaign. We actually decided to hold off on it from last week because we want to do it right. And we want to figure out, like, it was becoming like this, oh, we'd have to produce this whole thing. So we're going to do it in post. And then we do have fiscal sponsorship through the Gotham, which means that anyone who donates to the production gets a tax write-off, which you can find that buried in my link tree on my Instagram if anyone's interested in supporting. But I think the thing that's most important to me is letting it be a space for learning. And I want to be able to like share the learnings, the mistakes, the things that I'm going through on this podcast with the safe space of you, Jason, and Charles, who I know have my back. So hopefully like the listeners can also learn with me. Yeah, I've learned a lot. And I've learned that there's a lot of little softwares that have fees that you just have that you pay. And then you're like, ooh.
Yeah, that's filmmaking. It's funny. It's like the democratization of filmmaking. You can shoot something on your iPhone, but really like when you settle down to make something, where they really get you is the nickel and diming of these softwares that you have to use. At the end of the day, I feel like that's what you can get a camera for free. You know what I mean? Like everybody sort of knows somebody who has a camera, does whatever. It's really what it boils down to is like, oh, like why does Adobe cost this much? You know, like or whatever it is. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, those are like, that's the big checklist. I mean, the rest of it is just like in production. I think a lot of it we went over like rehearsing and shot listing and then just like figuring out your time management. I think it sounds like you have a lot of it ironed out. So much of it is now like doing it and then pivoting if it rains to that shot where they walk out and it's raining and then they look at each other and you hard cut back to their bedroom and the scene takes place there, you know?
Like, yeah. Yeah. Smart. Yeah. This is you writing on your feet. I love it.
Yeah. There's always something. I remember we did my first feature, Shovel Buddies, and I was just the writer on set with the directors, these two guys named Cyanad, who were just lovely and came from the commercial world. So they knew how to like work fast and efficiently, but also like had a look and were particular about different things and just the elements of like sometimes the best pages you wrote are unaccomplishable, you know, on the days or like the actor that you have for a day doesn't sell the scene the way you want. So now you're writing a new scene or doing whatever. And I think at the time, it's
how do you manage that?
It's joy and fear, right? It's the fear of first, oh my God, this isn't working. And then it's the joy of when you figure it out. And I think the first day it happened, it was something small. Like, hey, this room doesn't work the way the room in your script works. You know, like we don't have enough room, pun intended, in this room to move the camera to get this thing. So like, what's another shot we could do? Or how do you like, how else do you think someone could enter? And it's, you know, a brainstorm and time off shooting, which can freak you out, but then you get it and you get it in the water, you know, and you're like, okay, great. Yeah. That made up for the day. Now we kind of roll into this thing. So it's those little solves, but also it's not being afraid. And I'll say, like, that was a big lesson I learned in that movie, to write new scenes, you know, yeah. like, hey, this scene isn't going to work anymore. So we should just write a new scene, you know, and you could write it on the fly. And I think if you have good enough actors where you can do with the least amount of dialogue possible, you just need to get one or two things out. It's great. Mm-hmm. Like, we got completely boned by this house we were shooting in Shovel Buddies. And the neighbors were like, you guys are being too loud, so you have to leave. And it just cut our day in half. So it was like, okay, we have no transition now. It was supposed to be night out. We were shooting at 11 in the morning. The next shot is pitch black. What do we do? And I remember everyone's freaking out. And I sat with Cyanad and we were sitting and eating and talking and bullshitting. And I was like, oh, this is what the character should do. What if we just hard cut to them eating and talking and bullshitting? And it will wind up being a joke in the movie where it's like, they're like, we have to go now. Like, everyone's like, really? And it was supposed to go, you know, transition into the night. And they're like building stuff, but they, because we didn't have that house anymore.
Just like hanging
they're
out.
Just literally sitting on the hood of a car. They're eating In-N-Out burgers. One character slaps the burger out of the other character's hand. So it's like, you sort of get this dynamic. Like, you know, like they spit in someone's, but like hand it back. Like, it's very funny. We did it in this tracking shot where we just kind of go past them as they get in the car and then watch the car drive away. And it was something we did. I think we wound up shooting it at magic hour in 45 minutes in a parking lot that I'm not sure we 100% had permits for.
Oh.
It was just like, turn the camera. We decided we weren't going to have any dialogue, so we didn't have to set up sound. So just them, all body language stuff. And just like, a hey, you know, like one of those things we knew we could ADR.
I love it.
And it wound up being like one of my favorite shots in the movie because it's beautiful. It shows the dynamics. It also has this sort of element of just like kind of kids being kids, you know, like we're going to do it this way. And so I think like finding the ability to do that is nice. And, you know, don't be afraid of the new scenes you have to write. I mean, we had to write a whole day of shooting in there too, which is like, we had this cop scene that didn't work out. So we wound up shooting at the 7-Eleven and I had to come up with a scene on the fly for that. But it's like,
oh my gosh,
those are the scenes that wound up being my two favorite scenes in the movie. And I think just being okay with writing those scenes and figuring it out, even if it's something that you're like, oh my God, we just have to shoot in the room because now it's been raining all day, blah, blah, or like whatever it is, write it in there, you know, give them something to do, have it be fun, you know, kind of get crazy with it, but and be okay with that. Cause I think like, you can't solve the rain. You know, I can't solve neighbors doing whatever. Like,
you can't solve the rain.
Exactly. Yeah. If that's not a 60s song, it should be, but it's,
you really can't.
I mean, you can't solve the rain.
I was thinking Missy Elliott, you can't stop the rain.
Oh, yeah. Smarter. Yeah. I went all the way back to like the Chandrels, but I
think both things can be true at once.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah. Exactly. Hey, look, everyone's sampling anyway. It's all the same, but you know, you can't solve it. So just figure out, write that new scene.
I love how character-driven the scene, the specific scene of them sitting is. It's like, feels like so cinematic and so like...
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, you don't get those magic moments as much. And I think like when I look back at that script, I'm obviously very proud of it, but it's like, oh, I wish I had written more of those in there. So it's, you know, find a way to do it. Don't be afraid to shoot your own transitions that are fun or doing that. Or like, you know, I think your movie is
and
about
speed, right?
So many
speed
specific
doesn't
things.
Negate... Exactly. Speed doesn't negate quality necessarily.
Absolutely.
Like at that stage, like you're so entrenched in the story and the characters that like, of course you're going to be like, when you let your brain relax because you were eating in that moment, then like it came to you. Like that I think is something I'm trying to embrace in the process as well, is like, you know, you can't suffocate the life out of this thing. You have to let it be what it is.
Yeah. I think it's always, you know, there's a like, any leaving the cameras rolling is always smart. And we always hear these stories of these big Hollywood blockbusters where it's like everyone's favorite part is that time where like, oh, we just left the cameras rolling and this happened, or we did whatever and this happened. You know, it's like getting those nuanced performances or getting someone who like is breaking and then going back into character. You know, I think these little composition moments are the gems of what makes cinema
you
know, our most visual and our most emotional art form and our most human art form. So I think it's focusing on that. If you do that, you can't really fail at that point. You know, like you're still telling us a story and you're doing whatever. So, you know, focusing on that should be fun.
It's a perfect segue into tomorrow's interview with Kurt Laub, the editor of BlackBerry. And he speaks a lot about finding the mistakes in the film and building around that, whether it was a camera bump or a character dropping something, and to create something like truly beautiful. So I think that this list, if, to our listeners, you're in for a treat tomorrow. I love that conversation. And I love this conversation. Thank you so much, Jason, for believing in me and this project and being like—
You're going to crush it, yeah.
Oh, thank you. I feel very, very loved. Thank
good. Well, send me the script, ready to read it whenever, and, you know, enjoy Panama. I mean, I've never been. Sounds cool. Yeah.
I got the worst sunburn of my life there in middle school, so—
Yeah, part two. I can't wait to have, you know, beet red, Gigi bad. Yeah.
You're like, are you blushing? And I'm like, right. No, I'm just burnt as hell.
This is your podcast
where can,
now.
Yeah. Where can people, exactly, where can people follow your work?
It's at Jason Hellerman on Twitter. And you can just email me, Jason at No Film School, if you have questions, comments, concerns. And as I said many times, find me on that Fox lot. I'm always there. Sometimes I have the dog. Find me or Debbie. You know, she'll find me. But either way, we're around and happy to be out there. And, you know, we'll keep you updated from the front lines. And hopefully this is all resolved soon. We get back to it. And, you know, we're talking about shooting whatever I was working on next, which hopefully isn't bumped in the next year. Yeah.
And I'm at Lost in Graceland. If you're interested in helping out in our project, we're looking for some folks to help with. We need a colorist. We need post sound people. We haven't even talked about the post checklist, but it's something that is, I'm feeling the pressure. We're looking for a finishing editor. And I'd love to work with some folks from the No Film School family.
Yeah, bring it home, you know,
bring
you're
it
out
home.
There. Well, I think the one thing we learned from Eric and Matt last week, volunteer for it. You know, if you can do it, do it.
I love it. Okay, well, until next week.